Nice. Well, you will know, most of you, I think, why you're here for this topic. But I did want to start maybe just with the question of why did we choose this subject for this lecture today? And how does it fit in the series that we're doing this fall? We've chosen sort of as a... overarching theme for the fall season, the basic sort of longings of human beings, and to look at those as potential pointers or signposts, as we're going to call it, towards the truth about who we are as human beings, where we come from, or why we are the way we are, what the purpose and meaning of living here is. And we're taking the structure then for what we wanted to do in seven lectures from a book from the English theologian Tom Wright. Some of you will know who that is. And in Dutch, the book is called Zeven Wegwijzers, which means seven pointers, something like that. But I think it's too bad, a little bit, because they missed an important nuance in the original English title, which tells a little bit more. There, in English, the original title was called Broken Signposts. And with that word broken quite prominent there. And the basic idea in the book is that these seven basic longings that Tom Wright has chosen or identified, longings for justice, for love, for spirituality, for beauty, for freedom, for truth, and for power. He says with those, we can sort of make a basic profile of what it means to be human. And we realize if you take that seriously, it kind of asks for a little bit of explanation. What's the origin of that? And in what direction can you best pursue those things? Why are we like this? What are the ways we can best nourish or protect these longings? But then, as the title says, the way, if we just study ourselves, isn't totally clear for a few reasons. just looking at ourselves, we might be able to see what we long for, but that's no proof in itself that something exists as an answer to that longing, or even a reason why it's there. And, as he says, the way we express our longings is often quite broken, a bit confused, or maybe scattered all over the place in how we express our longings. So the way Wright then sees it is that a biblical vision, Judeo-Christian understanding of biblical revelation, the vision of a creation, a fall, and a redemption story, that's not only an answer to what some of these longings are that we have. It's also, maybe more importantly, a really, really strong explanation for why we have them in the first place, before answering them, just why they are there and why the struggle is there. So that's something we've thought in Le Brie for a long time. And so we thought, hey, this is a good direction. The founder of Le Brie internationally, Francis Schaeffer, was often speaking of human beings as a glorious ruin, something similar to a broken signpost, a glorious ruin. And that means that in spite of a broken existence, sort of we make a mess of things, and now including ourselves in a ruinous way. Still, in many respects, there are echoes and pointers to see in ourselves and in people around us the divine intention of how and why humans were made. The purpose and even the reality in which, and maybe for which, we've been placed, as we're told in the Bible, by God. And we hear something about that in God's revelation. Okay, so that's Wright's conviction. That's what we also believe in Le Brie, and that's what we wanted to do in this series. Now, I'm not going to say much more, in fact, almost nothing, about Tom Wright anymore after this, except thank you for the structure for these lectures with your seven longings, and we'll take it from here. What I chose for my contribution were the longings for beauty and the longings for spirituality. And you could tackle that in 100 different ways, and I hope you all bring some ideas in the discussion. But specifically, I chose to look at it by reviewing a trend which I've noticed the last few years, especially here in Holland. That's a growing fascination with nature and the natural world, not just as something healthy, which we've known for a long time in general, not just as something to keep your life balanced, but with a real clear emphasis on the spiritual experience that people can have in nature. And not always knowing why or how to put it in words, but choosing that kind of vocabulary to describe it, what you find in nature, and especially the beauty of nature. In the period of the lockdown, actually, you heard it a lot. And also since then, if people couldn't go to church anymore or other places where they normally found their inspiration, concerts or museums or whatever, still, people were allowed to go alone or maybe with one other person or with your dog into nature, right? You could take a walk in the woods. And by doing that regularly, especially in the contrast to the fact that nothing else really was possible, I heard a lot of people, people I know, but also just people in the media saying, man, what a amazing, beautiful, and almost revelatory experience this was to get out into nature again, to feel a connection that they'd lost or were discovering for the first time. People described how a walk in the woods or standing by a lake or going on the beach, when you had to keep distance and it wasn't a social thing, but you were just interacting with the natural world itself, how that could really change your attention, sharpen your senses, people spoke of how their bodies and their spirits sort of came up for breath, relaxed or found a new place of peace. They came into a more healthy rhythm by making this part of their day or part of their week. And not just for your physical condition, but also the serotonins and things that are released in your brain when you enjoy what you're doing. But of course, all those things are kind of physiological or mental. As holistic people, you heard a lot of people just saying, I don't know what my soul is, but this is clearly good for my soul. It's getting me deeper. Wandering through the woods, I can sort of relativize things a bit better, place things, understand things. I find a kind of rest and even an energy there that I don't find at home, or at the office or behind a screen somewhere else. Anyway, this is the way people were talking about it. I don't know if any of you recognize that. I see a few nods. But it was as though people were meeting something in nature, encountering something, not just themselves, but something that was giving them something good. Something, I don't know how you say, dat er iets goed gegund werd. It was as though somebody wanted you to find something good. There was something waiting to bless you there, as though it was sort of the intention and part of who we are. Something that we quickly forget in our daily busyness and routine. And the sense of satisfaction people were finding was big enough that after the lockdown, a lot of people didn't return to some of the old things they were doing, but just decided, no, it's nicer on Sunday morning to just go to the woods than to go sit in that old stuffy church service again. Now, I've also seen the trend in some movies, films in the recent time that have been popular. I think quickly first on two documentaries. One I was just talking about with Reda, My Octopus Teacher. I don't know if you guys have seen that, or The Biggest Little Farm. In both of these films, they're documentaries. But the whole point is to almost give an experience, not just a report, but an experience of how people have found a deeper relationship with nature through sort of a contact that they've made and a recognition they have felt, sort of learning to walk in the rhythms of nature and follow something and be blessed by something. And it's quite a holistic, and I think even they use the language, sort of a spiritual experience, a revelation. It leads to growth as well. something that is healing for them. And it's not abstract and floaty at all. It's quite rooted in this world, in the physical things that they are doing. Meeting an octopus, literally, in the sea, or really with your fingers in the dirt, and having to watch and learn from nature. And I guess getting more to the point for today, I've found a very good, a very interesting defense and explanation for this in a book, kind of a surprising book for me, because of who it was by, historian and writer Karen Armstrong. Don't know if some of you recognize that name. This book came out a few months ago, Sacred Nature. It's also translated in Dutch already, Heilige Natuur. You can easily order it. And I'm going to spend most of my time on this book today, because I think in general it's very representative of a lot of things I hear people saying, representative of the longings, you could say, that we have towards for beauty and spirituality in respect to nature. And I think it's also actually itself a very good example of what Tom Wright is talking about. A broken signpost. This book is, I think, a great example of a broken signpost. A sort of, in biblical language, you could call it an altar to an unknown God. And so I want to look at it in some detail with you guys. And so what we're going to do, I first just want to let you hear what her basic argument is in this book. Her vision of history, especially the history of religion. She's, of course, has become quite well known because of her, I think, quite impressive and unique study of the three great monotheistic religions in the book A History of God. Maybe some of you know that book. It came out in 2003, was very well sold and recognized and criticized. But anyway, it made a good big impact. But she also has done quite a study of Eastern traditions in the book Compassion, Compassi. Of course, the original American title was 12 Steps to Compassion. That's what we like to do out of every virtue. But in the Dutch version, it's just Compassion, a little bit. But both of these were bestsellers, and it reveals her interest in the topic and also her guts to research things quite thoroughly. And in the second book about compassion, she's really relating the Eastern traditions to how they could be better applied in the West. So she's interested in the applications always for daily living. And then, of course, in this book, Sacred Nature, she's really pushing for an understanding from the history of religion how Westerners, or at least Northern Hemisphere Westerners, but maybe people influenced by the West around the world, could better approach the climate crisis. Okay, that's her first urge, the climate crisis, what's happening with the natural world. And she wants to say maybe why we got here has something to do with religious history and what we can do to get better. Maybe we could learn something from religious history, specifically from religious traditions and practices, okay? So, what's her basic idea? After sort of revaluing different aspects of religion, what she wants to do in this book is basically this. She says, we need to recover the veneration of nature. Veneration means holding something high. Holding something as worthy of your respect and maybe even your worship. We need to recover the veneration of nature, our primordial link to nature, something that's built into us from the beginning. And that includes an aesthetic appreciation of nature, so its beauty, falling in love with its beauty again, and an ethical program that will guide our behavior and thoughts. And that's sort of her view of religion. An ethical program that will guide our behavior and thoughts. And so, to be clear, she says it's not a question of believing religious doctrines. She's not trying to be an evangelist for certain religions. But she says it is about incorporating or making part of our lives insights and practices that will not only help us to meet today's serious challenges, but also challenge our hearts and our minds. Okay, so she's looking for something in religious traditions that will help change us in our hearts and our minds and our appreciation of the beauty of nature, and also try to apply some kind of spiritual, or in her view, a religious ethical approach to how we interact with it. So after revaluing myth and the spiritual strength that she sees in certain traditions to view nature as something sacred, something holy or divine, she says, how can we learn from these traditions? She wants to give some examples and how to do that better ourselves, because we need to do it better. Now, I'm going to give a little spoiler about where I will go with this. I love her longing, and I see a lot of value in what she wants to do here. In fact, I completely agree with it, and I'm going to do it myself with you also. But I also have a lot of questions for her, especially about the way she views certain religious traditions, which I think is a bit romantic, how she does it. But I also have a question for her. What does she really mean when she speaks of how we can take the principles we find in different religions as true? She speaks of them as true. So what does it actually mean if, which is true for her, she doesn't really believe that there is a real supernatural being or reality behind these principles? Okay, that it's more to be seen as a very inspiring and valuable view and practice, but a real supernatural reality about it you can't really speak of. Okay, she has, I think, quite an interesting and unique meaning for the word sacred. It's actually quite a humanistic or secular use of the term, actually, sacred, as something kind of worthy of your respect that will help you change your behavior by treating something with more value than you had before. It's basically a practice, kind of pragmatic. Now, because she names it specifically, we're also going to look a little bit at what the Bible says. Because I actually learned something quite fun and new, kind of surprising from her, especially about the book of Job, Job in the Bible. She loves the book, and it's really interesting how she views it. I think it's great. But it also surprises me how she interprets some other texts in the Bible. We'll look at that. And then we'll close with a view, very short, of what I think the Bible itself presents as a foundation, a very strong foundation for the very thing that she is looking for. The very thing that she can describe herself very well as revaluing or venerating nature again with a high spiritual vision of responsibility. Okay, so little chunks. Don't be afraid. They're not really long, all these pieces. Okay. But that's the plan, all right? And we'll have plenty of time to talk about it, I think. So what is her book about? What's her goal in this book? What does she want to communicate? Well, she starts off with something most of us can agree on. We're becoming more and more convinced today that something's wrong with how we are treating nature, the natural world, and that has led to a crisis we are experiencing now, an environmental crisis or a climate crisis. And if we want to find a way forward, we need a different way of thinking. Okay? Or, as she says it, maybe we also need a different way of looking and of feeling. Different way of looking and feeling. In a way that, as she says, might be found in religions. Or at least a good example in religions of how we can look at nature in a better way. And in a way that in a lot of secularized Western contexts, we've lost. Okay? She says, again, I want to take this as kind of her thesis. We need to recover the veneration of nature. Our basic primordial sort of urs, she means with that, link to nature. And that means looking at its beauty, but also changing our ethical vision of how we behave towards nature and our thoughts. And again, it's not about any particular doctrine she wants to say, but more just insight and a practice that can help change our holistic relationship to nature itself. Now, she's looking for what we can learn, or maybe what we can relearn or rediscover, and how we look at nature and deal with the environment. Now, Armstrong herself was, as a teenager, a nun. in the Catholic Church, Catholic Order, in a convent. But before she took a permanent oath, she decided to go to university and study, and she ended up going a whole different direction with that very foundational study of those monotheistic religions that she did, and later the other traditions. So she knows a lot about religious traditions. She's not just an outside observer, and I have to compliment her on that. But here she wants to bring the theory of how different religions looked at nature and how, as history sort of developed, how those views influenced us where we are today in the West, whether we like it or not. And actually, she begins with the idea that in the Judeo-Christian tradition, okay, sort of the Christendom, part of the religious tapestry, rooted in the Hebrew scriptures of the Old Testament, she says it's very clear that there is an enormous distinction made between creator and creation, between the God who made the world and the natural world itself, and that this is a very strong central principle of the Judeo-Christian tradition, that Yahweh, the maker of this world and even the sustainer of the world, himself is not the world. Okay, and this is true. But through that, Armstrong says, what has developed in this Judeo-Christian tradition is that there's a tendency to give all honor and worship to the being of God at the cost of giving it to nature. That the view of something as holy, sacred, and divine should all be directed to Yahweh himself instead of, or at the cost of, looking at nature in this way. And she says, in her view, in her study, that this is a sort of departure from all other religious traditions, all other, as she sees it, religious traditions, including Islam, where God is seen as sort of behind or within all things, as a sort of general life energy or a sort of animating power that brings oneness to all material reality in a sort of divine picture. And that all of it, therefore, deserves holiness, a view of it as holy and sacred. She says it in her own words like this: unlike the other scriptures of other religions, the Hebrew Bible does not focus on the sanctity of nature, because the people of Israel experience the divine in human events rather than in the natural world. What she means by that is that Yahweh is seen, as she reads it, primarily in the Old Testament scriptures as a sort of source of victory, a kind of cultural or political victory for God's people, and a protector and a redeemer of people, okay, who call in God's help against an enemy. And that's how God is particularly seen, she says, or Yahweh in the Bible. Now, maybe some of you think, hey, this is a weird contrast, and we'll come back to that. But in her view, in her reading, you see that in order to call something holy or sacred, you need to see it itself as divine, as God or godly. Okay, so here, when you can see the natural world as divine or godly itself, sort of imbued or part of God, it's him or itself, then it is worthy of being called sacred. But if it's something made, then it's not worthy of being called sacred, if it's not God itself. Okay, that's sort of seems to be an assumption she makes in her explanation. Maybe you have another idea about that. I do. But let's first see where she goes with this idea. She says that, as sort of a follower of this Jewish tradition in the Christian development of culture, especially in the West, she believes that this sort of distinction between the Christian tradition and all the other traditions got even stronger in the Middle Ages, okay, in the medieval period. She says when, and again, this is very wide brushstrokes here over history, but for the sake of time and also for her book, with an increasing emphasis on the mind in the Middle Ages, especially in theology, she says people started to see God more and more as just another being, Okay, just another sort of personality, albeit of a superior kind, rather than just being itself, a more philosophical principle of just sort of a force. In theology, in the medieval times, she says, there was more emphasis on a God who made creation and reacts on creation and uses creation, rather than seeing any kind of godly or divine power in nature itself. Nature was more of just a material and a resource and a tool. And she says this was where the departure of the Western tradition really left other religions behind. She even calls it a break with the more traditional understanding of the sacred in nature. So when this became even more attached with a growing interest in science, with research into the natural world, there came another deep and serious break. She said there was a break with the ingrained, okay, or sort of built into human primordial urge, the pagan, she calls it, habit of revering nature. People in the West with this theological and scientific influence got the idea we must control and subdue the earth as God has commanded. Nature was no longer a theophany or a revelation of the divine. It was a commodity to be exploited. Okay, big words there, but I think you can follow what she means. It just became a thing to be used with the justification of this worldview behind it. So the idea was that as God's image bearer, human beings could also just exploit nature, treat it as a sort of possession, something you needed, something you could use to get what you want and what you need to survive. So nature is there more or less as a theater for the human drama, you could say, sort of a source of natural resources for us. And that's what she said was the average view of the medieval thinking Christian. She takes it even a step further with Descartes, she says, and certain philosophical developments that came along with the Enlightenment. Descartes even concluded that we could see through the modern mind that the material universe was lifeless, godless, and inert, just something to be explored and studied and used, and there was no longer the occasion to wonder at anything that can be seen. She's quoting Descartes there. Now, whether Descartes is lamenting this or not, we probably should research, but she takes it as a statement of progress here, that we don't need to be mystified, bewildered, or amazed by nature anymore. It's better just to be scientific and utilitarian about it. And indeed, that was encouraged as all kinds of scientific explanations for things, for the universe and how things work. It left very little room anymore for a sort of holy amazement at nature, right? You know, the old example that when the rainbow is explained as droplets reflecting light, that's pretty cool, but to see it as a mythic, symbolic, inspirational thing that's sort of challenged, demythologized, to use a big word. And she says in the work of Isaac Newton, you see, okay, nature itself follows this trend. It's in itself nothing. It's actually only interesting, only even dynamic once God moves it. Okay, in itself, it's nothing. It's just inert material. But when God moves it and uses it, well, there comes the amazement. It's all about God. There's no respect for nature itself in and of itself. God is seen as dominatio, in the words of Newton, an ultimate will, right? And so we should embody that as well and take the same view of nature. She says this God was simply a larger, more powerful version of the human scientist and therefore an inspiration. And then she makes a fairly dramatic claim. Some of Newton's physics soon became outdated, she says, but his theology has remained influential in Western thought. And that's why we now have a problem that the average Western person doesn't really look at nature with a kind of care and attention, and certainly not with sort of awe and humility and respect. And therefore we have made a mess of things. Now, that's why she then makes this call. We need to recover this lost religious sacred view of nature, the one that's actually built into us from the beginning. We need to correct this departure. And again, it's not about real religious truths. It's looking to the past for some examples of how we can cultivate a better attitude in ourselves. Okay, that's the basic argument of the book. A lot more detail. I have it here if you want to look later. I do recommend reading it. It's not hard to read. It's not a heavy study book. But I do want at this point to make three comments. The basic theme, the red thread, as we say in Dutch, the theme she wants to draw through history there, I can really understand on the one hand, because I think it is true that not just the average Western thinker, but I would say even more, the average Western Christian thinker, you can find plenty of examples of those who have no honor or respect for nature, and who regularly speak of the natural world as something to be used, or something that's going to burn anyway, and we can better be focused on souls, God, worship of God, and here we are in bodies temporarily anyway. So it doesn't really deserve any kind of holy awe or respect. I think that I understand why she comes with this sort of explanation. However, I have three critical questions about her narrative here. I think, first of all, her opening statement, her opening vision, where she starts about the biblical vision, I don't really see as correct. The fact that a very clear distinction is made between God as a personal creator and the material of a creation, which is also in the Bible seen as very living and very dynamic, doesn't necessarily lead to a vision that all honor and respect goes only to God at the cost of nature, deserving any kind of awe or respect. There would be a way to see this very distinct structure quite differently, maintaining very separate existences and personalities, and still see that a God makes a creation with love, gives humans responsibility to care for that natural world with the same love and respect and sense of wonder, and to cultivate it and to care for it. Okay, it's simply not true that if you have a God who is not him or even herself part of nature itself, seen as some kind of energy or force, but to see God and the Creator as a separate personal being, it doesn't immediately mean that you have no respect for nature itself. I don't follow that argument. It could be very logical that the humans in the story get a very disciplined and urgent and important calling to treat nature with holy respect. Okay, Armstrong just chooses not to read it that way. A sharp example of this comes in a chapter of her book about the Bible. She comes back to this idea that her original interpretation, that a separate creator and a creation will lead to undervaluing the creation. She reads, gives a reading of Psalm 8, the 8th Psalm, and she says it like this. In this Psalm, Yahweh is presented as the creator and the ruler of the cosmos. And when the psalmist looks up at the moon and the stars that his God has single-handedly set in place, he does not, she says, he does not dwell on their extraordinary beauty and inherent sanctity. The psalmist's thoughts turn almost immediately to man, whom Yahweh has appointed as ruler of nature. And the marvels of nature have been reduced to mere accessories of the divine. Okay, so in her lens, this is how she reads the psalm. That for the psalmist, because looking through the stars and the moon leads him to make a comment about God and God's calling for humans, she says, well, nature doesn't matter really at all here. It's not seen as something valuable in and of itself. all the attention goes to God and then eventually to humans themselves as the only valuable thing. Now, I think it is true in the psalm that sort of being amazed by the stars and the moon, the psalmist does turn to something about human beings. But if you actually read the psalm, it's not to say, well, here we are as ruler of the planet, we can do with it what we want. It's actually very, very full of humility. The vision that he gets is not lifting up himself as a godlike user of the planet. It's very full of humility. What is man, even, the psalmist asks, in this very psalm, that you are even mindful of us, the Son of Man? What are we that you even care for us? And yet, you've given us responsibility to care for this creation of yours. You've granted us and called us to something very important, to take care of this place. So it isn't as though the psalm concludes with this, oh, lecker, you know, we have this power like God to abuse the world as a scientist might in a careless way, to just use it up, and just to use stars and moons as symbols of other things without any kind of thankfulness or humility. I think that's just a wrong reading of the psalm. She makes the same kind of weird contrast, I think, in her reading of Psalm 104, which, if you'll read it later, you'll see it describes the natural world in a lot of detail, lots of scenes of nature, but full of amazement, by the way, full of wonder in how they are described very poetically, full of language of wonder. But she says, because in the psalm we read that the creation needs God to live and to be protected, Armstrong concludes that nature itself in the psalm is not seen as holy or important anymore. Only God is. So nature is there just sort of as an empty thing which needs God to be considered valuable. I don't think that that's the right way, again, to read the psalm with this kind of contrast. If Yahweh does love his creation and is bent over it with care, like we see described in the psalm, feeding the animals, making things run, caring for it, then the message of the psalm is that the humans should emulate that. Also, with just as much love and amazement, look to the natural world. To imitate that, you could say, with a holy view and respect for what God has made. Not contrasting it or letting it compete with a worship for God, in a sense, but seeing God as the ultimate creator and maker, deserving of our worship, but then valuing what he's made with the same love he has for it. Just not worshiping nature itself. Now, we'll come back to this, because I do think, actually, the real biblical vision, I think, is an amazing and awesome foundation for what she wants, okay, for her whole theme and thesis. I just want to show here that it's not necessarily the case or necessarily logical even that, oh, here's the natural world saying hello.
Hello.
Oh, did she come in out of the rain? Is that? Ah. Good job, Lily. You don't have to see something as divine itself, namely the natural world, to see it as something worthy of a godly level of love, honor, and respect, and as something sacred. But Armstrong chooses to read the Bible that way. Okay, back to her story, though. That's sort of my first main comment. Why would you need to see something itself as God or a God to see it as holy, worthy of respect and honor? I don't follow that necessary step, especially when you read the Bible. Back to her story. The second comment I want to make about her approach is that I think it's actually much more likely that our misuse of nature today, the natural world, our lack of respect for nature, actually comes through an increasing secularization in our culture more than any particular theological development as she sees it. So isn't it more likely, that's what I want to ask her, that an increasing secularization in general is more responsible for our loss of respect for nature than any particular theological development in the Middle Ages? I don't know if we today are more influenced by the image of God as a scientist, and therefore we can misuse nature? Or are we today more influenced by the idea that we don't really have room for God at all anymore as reality? And therefore nature is just there as material, just as we are, to make the best and most efficient use of. Okay, there isn't space in society now for God as a creator and a redeemer. And I would see that as a much more likely explanation than a particular vision of God having influenced us that way. Humanism and naturalism as movements, I think, were much more influential in the Industrial Revolution than some or other theological vision. We can talk more about that if there are other experts here who could add to that or correct that or challenge it. But I think it's more likely that a lack of respect for nature comes through secularization itself and not through a particular religious trend and a Judeo-Christian religious trend. While admitting in many Christian circles there is a high disrespect for nature as well. But I would say that would actually be a secularized form. A modern form of a Christian religion than something that's biblical. Thirdly, I want to say, ask a question. In the countries and the cultures where these other religions thrive and are most influential, the ones that she holds up quite high in the book, where there's sort of a belief in a kind of force or an energy behind all things, sort of life energy, where that's the main vision of that life and that land and that culture, is it actually true that there we see a higher respect for nature and the natural world? And I have big questions about that. Do the other Eastern religious frameworks really lead to more respect and care for nature? Do we see that in the lands and the cultures where those traditions have the most influential role? She sees the... I think it's actually quite the opposite in China and India, which she holds up quite high. I think they are just as well known as the West for natural disasters, for looking at the earth as a source of natural resources and just using it. And we'll come back to that in a minute. Armstrong sees the Chinese traditions of qi, or qi, energy, and the Tao. She sees that worldview and that vision of life and creation as better than the Judeo-Christian one with this separate creator God. And she says it in her words like this: in the vision of the Tao and the Qi, people are not seeking a supernatural God in the distant heavens. They are honoring a force in the world itself. She says that's the predominant view in Chinese religion, or the religious view in China. And she says in India, it's the same with the belief in the Brahman. She says, while we in the modern West have confined God up there to the heavens, the people of India have continued to emphasize the ubiquity, or being everywhere, of the sacred throughout the world. And I think theoretically, or maybe in writings, this may be true, but I think it's an extremely romantic vision when it comes to the actual practical consequences that we can see in these countries and these lands and how they view nature and how they treat the natural world. And then not even to speak much about human rights and the equal value seen in all people, men and women, high or low. Now, I'm not naming this to say, see, everybody's just as bad as the Christians. I'm not playing that game. I do just want to make the point that in her high value for this pantheistic vision, maybe she misses the fact that that also doesn't give any guarantee that you're going to treat nature with more respect or see it as more sacred, and that it may not lead to immediately to necessarily to a different kind of practice with regard to nature. Now, I want to give her some sympathy here, because I actually understand a little bit. I think this comes because she herself, Armstrong, is a bit of a romantic, and me too. She has sort of a tendency in that direction. She does admit she has a very warm heart for the English, the British romantic poets, Wordsworth and Coleridge. I wrote my first thesis on these writers myself, so I understand why she loves them, and they are also known for having a very high vision of the natural world. It's true, as something inspiring, even divine, something that can call to the child of nature in all of us, and that can be called up and tasted in a natural world experience. But I think Armstrong also forgets that these poets also never mentioned the side of nature that is destructive, very impersonal, completely disregarding human beings. It was a very anthropomorphic way the poets approached nature, as though it were your lover, when we have plenty of stories of people with this romantic vision going out into the wild, trying to find this great romantic relationship with nature and being eaten by a bear or just dying of starvation because nature actually doesn't care. That you don't find back in the romantic poets. Okay, I think they remind us of one truth, but they leave the other one out. And actually, a very true pagan religion, they were not romantic poets in their literature about nature. They were terrified of nature in real, and still today, truly pagan pantheistic religions are more terrified. It's not just wonder and amazement and nature is holy. It's nature can and will kill you, and the gods behind the nature need to be appeased all the time. Nature is something that is angry, and it's on top of you, and it will punish you if you don't calm it down or please it. Okay, and I think her romanticism in this aspect, the glasses she has on, goes quite far. In a chapter on kenosis, which she sees as a religious habit of sort of emptying yourself, she sees in a lot of Eastern traditions. She says, in the Eastern cosmologies, creation is not attributed to an extrinsic divine power, but it's understood as a dynamic force working tirelessly and subtly within everything. Okay, it's this very loving, creative force in and behind and within everything. And maybe you think, hey, maybe that sounds like something like a nice vision of evolution, or some kind of spiritual, nourishing vision behind creation. Or is it Darwinistic? And she wants to answer that question immediately, to show how romantic she views the natural world. She says, by the way, this is not at all a Darwinistic vision. Instead of a Darwinistic vision where nature is seen as red in tooth and claw, that's an old poetic description of the natural world as bloody in its competition, fighting and clawing and biting each other to win. She says, no, we shouldn't see the natural world developing like that, the result of an endless competition for dominance. But in Hinduism, she says, we encounter a never-ending kenosis in which everything creatively and spontaneously yields to one another. It's a much more beautiful vision, but it is also one in which the red tooth and claw is made beautiful. You're asked to see it as beautiful. All the death and the suffering in the world is not really bad in that sense anymore. It's part of a beautiful cycle, and that might actually justify ignoring some suffering around you or ignoring the destruction of the natural world. It's all part of a beautiful cycle. Okay, so there's a weird romantic numbing going on here to the dangerous, impersonal, or difficult part of a relationship with the natural world. I think the problem of this romantic vision actually bubbled up later in the book, when she was speaking about the high point of Hinduistic meditation. The high point of that tradition is called the samadhi, she says. And in a footnote, she defines samadhi like this. She says, samadhi is a state of consciousness in which a person is so absorbed in meditation that she loses awareness of the physical natural world. Now, that was in a footnote. But it jumped out to me. It's like, wait a minute. How then, which she's holding this up as the highest spiritual practice, how then could this be the basis for a real involved, caring, physical relationship with the natural world as something holy and valuable? Because your highest spiritual moment, it disappears. Doesn't that contradict a little bit? Now, she doesn't go into that, but that just appeared in a footnote, and I thought it was quite important. So I want to say, in her view, I do see something a bit, I think naive is a strong word, but I do think it's a romantic vision of these Eastern traditions as a practice. I think she also underestimates secularization as a source of our current misuse of nature. And I think she overestimates the role of Christian thinking in that, based on a wrong interpretation of the Bible. So I have a lot of critique, actually, about the book. But, and now I want to get back to maybe the biggest point of the evening. I still love what she wants to do with this book. I still love what her thesis is. And I actually can agree with this wish that she has right here. That we need to recover an honor of nature. Not just an appreciation of its beauty, but an ethical program. Maybe there's a right and wrong in it. That will guide our behavior. Because we can't come up with it ourselves. We need a guide. Something we can incorporate into our lives. Insights, so some revelations, and some practices that will not only help us concretely meet today's challenges, but heal us holistically in our hearts and minds. I could totally stand behind this as a goal. Well, how? Now, again, before jumping totally to the biblical vision as I see it, I got one last question for Armstrong. Because alongside all these critical points, one thing I really thought was great and hilarious about her book, I was reading it on vacation, and I had to bother my whole family in the car because they couldn't run away, explaining, isn't this amazing how she sees the book of Job? And they're like, oh, God. Okay. But religion is a weird sort of truth for Armstrong, first of all. It's not about doctrines, she said, right? There isn't really truth in any moral standpoint, she says, or doctrine about any kind of religion, especially when it comes to supernatural reality. The value of religion, she says, comes in the fact that it's a mythical story. It's a myth. It's thought up by human beings to give life a meaningful color. She says it quite literally. This is her claim. Humans are meaning-seeking creatures. And myths were created for making sense of their moribund and precarious lives. Moribund and precarious means, I think, what the pagan knows, a bit in the shadow of death and very vulnerable. And humans made up stories to direct their attention away from this dark place to things eternal and universal. Humans were compelled to devise, to invent stories that enabled them to place their lives in a different setting and give them the conviction that, against all the depressing evidence to the contrary, life does have meaning and value. This is a pretty honest and deep statement. It's exactly what Alain de Botton has often said, many other thinkers you may know. Our longings for meaning, our deep tendency, for example, to treat the beauty of nature as something worthy of real respect, the power of nature as something in front of which I can be humble, my longing to have a deep spiritual awareness of my responsibility to nature and to care for it, those are not actually really pointers to any kind of reality or truth. They are a sort of a random desire that I have. And in human history, we have invented stories to treat those seriously, to take them seriously, and to act as though they are real. It's a very pragmatic vision of spirituality, this, I would say. And again, maybe we want to agree with that or fight for it. Okay. But I think it's so pragmatic that it's not really spiritual anymore in the real meaning of the word. There is only material in the end, plus a made-up story around it. And still, Armstrong believes that this kind of a story, if we would just sort of act it out as a kind of theater and drama, it will give us a renewed heart and mind for how we treat the natural world. She says we need these myths that help us to honor Earth as sacred again. Because unless, and listen to this, unless there is a spiritual revolution that challenges the destructiveness of our technological genius, we won't save the planet. Okay, so she really believes we can take on this theater in a way, and it's urgent, and we need to. And that's why we need, she says, a new attitude toward the natural world to deepen our spiritual commitment to the environment. And I said, man, I really wonder, can I really change my attitude, really? Can I really have a spiritual revolution, changing my heart and my mind, if I know at the bottom of it, it's a made-up story? Now, I, at this point, jump over to side with Tom Wright, who says, no, we need more than that. Our longings for spirituality and for beauty, in this case, if I want to take that seriously, seriously enough to change my life and my heart and my view towards nature, and especially if I pick up a book that says I'm going to learn something about the sacred value of nature, I want to hear more than that it's a kind of theater and that it's a kind of game play. Instead of a good story that's not true but maybe motivational, I'd rather have a real gospel of good news. Something that maybe is mythic in its reach, you know, like C.S. Lewis one time said about the Bible, that it is mythical, mythic in its reach, but it is also true. That's what I would be looking for, a story that gives a very good and strong explanation for why we feel the way we feel, why that is meaningful. And instead of a fiction that sort of leaves me with a split personality, that it touches my heart and my gut, but it leaves my mind on the side, knowing that it's fiction, I'd rather one that unites me holistically, that I can also say with my mind it's true. So now I do want to look at the Bible. Now, as I said, Armstrong really does have one part of the Bible she wants to recommend, and that's the book of Job. And she thinks it's an amazing book, really relevant for today, and that everybody should read it. And I think that that's kind of funny, actually, because in Christian circles, the book of Job is actually one of the stories that's the most difficult. It's the one people don't want to read or want to do studies over because it's difficult to place. Job's extreme suffering doesn't get any answer from God. Not clear to Job what this whole miserable world is about and what's happening to him. But that aside, for Armstrong, for Karen Armstrong, Job is the only story in the Bible that's relevant for today. And listen to why she says. In the time of his suffering, Job stubbornly insisted on his innocence, loudly lamented his fate, even fell into profound despair. And why? Because he was entrenched in his all-too-human egotism. And he turns his back on the entire cosmos. Why, he demands to know, should a virtuous man suffer? It's a typically anthropocentric question, she says. Okay? So it's very typical that we as humans want to know, what about me? Everything is about me. You know? There are bad things going on in the world, but it's me whose trouble and problem should be answered. Why, God, am I suffering? And, she says, when God finally responds to Job, he pointedly ignores it. He ignores this demand, and she loves that. She thinks that that's great. She says, instead, God compels Job to face up to the limitations of his understanding and bombards him with questions of his own that Job finds impossible to answer. And Armstrong thinks this is a fantastic slap for this anthropocentric, arrogant, selfish human, Job. We might agree with that, but listen to what Armstrong says. This is the lesson now we need to take from this book. She says, God reveals in his answers a cosmos of staggering beauty in which violence and suffering are essential to the life of all species. Okay, when God describes a lot of the natural world to Job in his questions and in his reply to Job. But then Armstrong says, and instead of lamenting the hardships that they endure, God holds up these animals as courageous and splendid. That's the point of the story that God is telling Job. And he's saying that human beings would do well to follow the example of those animals. Instead of whining self-indulgently like Job, they must learn that they are not the center of the world. Okay? So she says, like Job, we should better just put our hands over our mouths, shocked out of our self-centered complacency. Now, I find this a really curious reading of Job. I think it's amazing, and I love that she spends so much time working it out, because, yes, it is true. The story is about the necessary humbling or humility of Job. I'm not sure it's a humiliation, like she says, but it is a humbling. That it's not always about my individual suffering and that I need to know the answer to it before I can have happiness or peace or trust God, that I'm the center of the story. But the point is not, if you read the book, that Job is supposed to now bow before the courage and the stoic survival attitude of the animals and just accept everything. The point of the story is that Job can now bow and kneel before God, not just with a complaint about his suffering, but also a trust that God is not deaf, that God does have his hand over all of creation in a loving and caring way, and that God, in his wisdom and in his love, does care for this world and has from the beginning and will continue to. Now, maybe that doesn't answer all Job's questions, so the humility is needed. But the point was that he could trust and worship God as a carer for the creation, not that he would turn to the animals as a source of stoic, a kind of strange survival acceptance of their fate. She says this, in our modern world, we are taught to value our achievements, to assert ourselves and our opinions, and constantly to promote ourselves, sometimes quite aggressively. And I like that she sees in Job, we are given a good reminder. We need that reminder, she says, a sharp reminder of the essential frailty of our humanity that enables us to see ourselves realistically and then hopefully improve. And that's based on realizing how little we know, how frequently we fail in kindness to other beings, how limited our desires and our yearnings are, which so often begin and end in ourselves. And I would agree with that. And that is part of the lesson of Job. But in the Bible, the answer does not lie in then worshiping nature as God. And definitely not as an impersonal force or just a kind of distracting beauty. There's a much deeper answer in the Bible about how to achieve this point and this reminder. And that's in finding the true root of our longings, which are very meaningful and intrinsically meaningful, and to hear why we have them and to learn how we can nourish and protect them in what way we can grow. Even again, in Karen Armstrong's own words, she says we should learn to align ourselves with the natural world emotionally and realize our affinity with, that means how we are built to have a good relationship with it, and our utter dependence on it. It's almost at the end of her book, and I would say, yeah, and this is what the Bible gives us. So now I want to set that up as a recommendation, if this is what we're looking for. And then we'll see where we want to take it and how we talk about it. In Genesis 1, the people are described, the first humans are not described as the first part of creation, but actually the last part. They enter the story of creation at a very late place, you could say. God is busy for a very long time before that, with the rest of nature, with a lot of attention and even love, you could say, and value, naming many of the steps good, intrinsically good along the way, before humans are even there. And finally, humans enter as part of this creation. They are put in this environment as a piece of it, okay, related to it physically, materially, biologically, bound into it, you could say, and also dependent on it, what she says, for life, okay, dependent on God through that creation. So the calling and the assignment that the humans receive at that time has everything to do with a loving relationship to the physical flora and fauna of the natural world. That's a core part of the story. First thing humans are asked to do is to give names to all the animals, the fauna, all the animals, to look at it with value and attention, to name it, to have a kind of relationship, you could say, at least to it. And then with all the flora, asked to get to know the garden and to care for it and to work it and to cultivate it, to ensure that it remains fruitful and flourishing as a source of life. Okay? Not just to see it as a source of food or just a distracting, sort of pleasant, beautiful thing to taste. It's something that's deeply valued. And that's even spoken of with great and poetic language at other places in the Bible, including Psalm 104. Okay, so in the actual biblical vision, I would say, not the way Armstrong presents it, in the actual biblical vision, it's intended that human beings are going to cultivate the world in harmony with it, in a deep, good relationship, a flourishing relationship with the natural world. And that's called shalom. It's not peace in the sense of the end of conflict. It's shalom is the dynamic movement of a flourishing ecosystem, including humans. Okay, not just to do with the natural world what they want, not just to be abusive to animals as the source of food or whatever, but as a loving carer and sort of citizen of the natural world. Now, there is an instruction, on the other hand, not to see animals or plants, or planets and stars as something to worship as gods themselves. There is that instruction. But there is the instruction to see them as sacred gifts. Ways that you can even get to know more about God Himself. And maybe ways to even learn more about a spiritually responsible way to live here on earth. King Solomon in the Bible was well known for his deep research and knowledge of the natural world, all aspects of the natural world, plants and gardens and animals, the behavior of creatures and even reading the weather. And again, it wasn't always to develop or to give some kind of spiritual lesson or a proverb. It was first just curiosity and wonder and appreciation for the world he'd been given by God. Well, sometimes it did lead to some wisdom. Go look at the ant. He says in a proverb, right? You lazy bones, go look at the ant. Without any leader, still the ant knows how hard you need to work to take care of yourself. Okay, so the complexity of the animal world, wow, humans could learn something from that. Jesus himself later says, consider the lilies, on the other hand, who don't work and strive for their existence, but are cared for and dressed even beautifully by God. So the complexity of life by observing the natural world is there. Our affinity with nature and dependence on it, and also on God. And Solomon could do this because he was very aware of the framework. That we don't find ourselves randomly in a complex world. We are placed here as loving participants, responsible caretakers, humble, dependent creatures, who are at the same time image bearers of God as creative, self-aware, capable cultivators. And no other creature in creation was given that responsibility. So it is a special place. I think Armstrong says, I gave you ants and lilies. We should also observe, right? We weren't just told. There they are. Armstrong says herself, right near the end of the book, in a conclusion, she says this, we must go beyond the secular humanism that formed the anthropocentric ethos of the Enlightenment. I agree with that. We should develop an anthropocosmic mentality, she says, that unites the individual with the community and preserves the harmony between the species and the non-human world. Now, I agree with that, but it's really interesting. How do you get that? Do you get that by making it anthropocosmic in the sense that I am just absorbed into everything as one? Or do I need something that gives me unity and diversity if I'm going to talk about harmony between species and individuals? I need something that preserves the individual and not just blends it all into one thing, but still somehow gives a high human role to a place within the whole. And I think in a pantheistic vision, you don't get this. You lose the individual value. You lose, in the end, the special role. It becomes very difficult to separate diversity in any meaningful way. And it becomes even more difficult to separate one attitude from another when it comes to suffering as any kind of way to move forward or care for each other or care for the future or care for the natural world. Okay, that's just left up to a person or an impersonal, beautiful energy. So I actually think the Bible supports what she's looking for way better than the pantheistic vision she's putting forward. It doesn't actually give them anything helpful. So in this series, we said we want to start by taking human longings seriously. So I want to take those human longings for beauty and for spirituality seriously in the context of nature. And then I tried to make up a little list. If I want to take them seriously, I need a foundation that describes, explains, and justifies our lives here, humans, not as owners of the world, but as stewards, if you know that, or caretakers of the world. That explains our existence here not as gods or absorbed into godhood and disappearing or being abusive as gods, but as image bearers. Reflecting something of the divine with the responsibility, but not gods ourselves. We're not to be seen as creators in the sense that just having ownership and can exercise my will as I want over something, but as creative, for sure, builders. Not seen as autonomous, just having my will that I can exercise or make up stories or laws about it, but responsible, literally, for unworldly, giving an answer to a command that's been given to me. Again, not absorbed into the cosmos, but eternal individuals. Also not seen just as animals running around, but animals, yes, but with heart, soul, and reason, able to understand God's revelation. And again, lastly, I think not here just taking part in some kind of fiction, or sort of conscious fiction or dance or game, but given a true role, a real true role. And that does take some humility to say, okay, this God may have revealed something of himself to me in the Bible, and other parts of the Bible I find difficult, but at least this is an interesting foundation that I think fits very well with what she's looking for. So that was my plea for how we could move towards a higher view of sacred nature, quite justified by the Judeo-Christian biblical tradition, and with some critique on suggestions of other ways to do it. That was what I wanted to tell. And now, I'm curious, where do we go? What do we do? And in what direction? Do you want to return to any of these things, to ask or challenge or say something extra? Or if you have other comments, ideas about this?
Can you understand the choices that she made?
Yeah.
Because she has a very broad public.
Yes.
And she don't want to go to step in the dynamic of dogmatic discussion.
Of course.
So she made a kind of political statement, mm-hmm. Or a political decision that she begin with nature because that is closest by.
Yep.
But can you understand it that she made those kind of decisions?
Yeah. I totally agree with her premise of what the purpose is. Totally. That a return to a spiritual evaluation of nature is very likely to help and good to try. And I think she also surfs a bit on the general feeling that many of us have discovered, like, ooh, I feel something spiritual and important on a walk in the woods, and I don't need to define it. Maybe it is one with everything. But when she goes further to say it is a pantheistic vision and not a biblical vision that will help, then I want to enter the dialogue, taking her seriously as well. But of course I understand the impetus, and I actually like it. I now want someone to write the same book and present the biblical vision as well, in joining the dialogue.
So without the judgment about a Judeo-Christian view, mm-hmm. you say, oh, I understand the reasoning.
Yeah.
So you can be critical about what she say about the Christian or Judeo-Christian view
yeah.
on reality. But the decisions he made,
yeah.
you can understand.
Yeah. I would say still...
Not only the goal, not only the longing, mm-hmm. but also the decisions she made in her reasoning.
Yeah, but I do still think she made some mistake in overestimating the positive and not mentioning some of the negative effects of the religious tradition she defends. And I do think she misreads some of the Bible. So just that's part of it. I would say I still disagree with that. But I mean, she's obviously highly intelligent and following a logical flow. Once she decides the Judeo-Christian view separates God and dishonors nature, of course it flows. And once she decides that a pantheistic vision elevates nature and treats it all as holy, I think, of course, that follows. I think even if she never mentioned the Bible, I would still ask her, how do you explain the similar kinds of natural disasters and disregard for human life that happen in cultures where the religions you are defending as correct are actually in charge? Now, an interesting thing is she doesn't talk at all about any real pagan, African or South American animistic religious traditions here, which I think in some people's view, or Aboriginals maybe, in Australia, where they are nowadays seen as living very close to nature, and more than most. But I think I know why she didn't. One is that's not her expertise, so she doesn't want to play an amateur, which I respect. But two, those religious traditions are terrified of nature, live in constant fear of the natural world. It isn't just a sort of Disney harmony with nature. And I think that might make it more difficult, her argument, to say let's turn to those religions as a source of environmental care.